10, but I don't think you'll really be noticing that too much with the wind and the rain. For Northern Ireland, a risk of some ice first thing. A largely fine start there, albeit with some hazy sunshine. Rain arriving, however, by the end of the morning will linger on into the afternoon and turn heavier. The wind will also strengthen. Highs of 8 or 9 for Northern Ireland. Finally, onto Scotland, a chilly start. Some wintry showers first thing, but generally that will be the driest and brightest part of the day. There'll be some early sunshine, I think, in the east around the Murray Firth. But as the day goes on, things will cloud over from the west. Rain initially into the west during the afternoon will reach all areas during the evening. And again, we're going to be up against some very strong winds. Highs of 7 or 8 for Friday for Scotland. On into the weekend, the potential for more wet and windy weather into the start of next week, into Monday and into Christmas Eve. So do stay tuned to the forecast, particularly if you plan on travelling. There could be some disruption.
All sounding very lively there. Thanks, Susan. Susan Powell at the BBC Weather Centre. Now we continue. Darling Monster. Letters written from Lady Diana Cooper to her son John Julius Norwich, who introduces some of that correspondence. The year is 1948, and the society beauty is being hounded by paparazzi and prurient journalists. How little has changed half a century later. The letters are read by Patricia Hodge.
My darling, I've wanted to call you my darling. For many and many a day.
Venice, August the 22nd, 1948. Darling Monster, I got your letter yesterday. A great joy. My melancholia is so bad that it made me cry. Don't ask me why, because I don't know. I'm making Papa's life a misery. Meanwhile, in Venice, the Biennale plods on. The English exhibition of pictures, Turner First, is excellent. The cream of the show for me. A mediocre collection of French impressionists, a ghastly modern French room of ordures, another of Picasso, interesting Italian sculpture, and some American turds. The films take place in the afternoon and evening at the Lido in a mammoth airless cinema. Dressed to Kill, we went by launch to help inaugurate it. The English kicked off with The Red Shoes, a picture to show that ballet can be filmed. Moira Shearer of Sadler's Wells is the star, and there are lovely things in it, including Massine and Technicolor, but it's an hour too long. The story is puerile. When it was over, we were all convoked to a party at the Excelsior, supper and dancing al fresco. I asked the head waiter who is receiving, as I wanted to make an act de présence. I am, he said. So I said, we shan't need a table.
And now, as the letters make all too clear, depression struck my mother, as bad, I think, as she had ever suffered. Melancholia, as she called it, had always been the bane of her life. She worked hard to conceal it from the outside world, but never made any secret of it to my father or to me. True, she did have a reason this time. My father was obviously very far from well, though whether he was half as ill as she imagined, we shall never know. Meanwhile, they'd left the British Embassy and were settling into their new home at Chantilly, outside Paris.
Chantilly, July the 26th, 1948. Unnecessary to tell you that I had a hideous day in London. It was too hot for my dark blue woolen dress, and I felt sordid and unworthy of anything better than our business adviser, Mr. Hart of Gilbert Samuel and Company in Liverpool Street. I got so hot and cross during the interview that I began to unbutton, in fact, undress like the very mad. Mr. Hart mumbled something about strip-teasing, and that made me hotter and smellier. I have a theory that rage as well as fear makes your sweat glands smell. There was nothing I suggested that could be effected. I must let Bogner, furnished, for 3 years to cover rent, gardener, maid, repairs, and then you will be 21, and I can give it to you, and not dare to die for another 5 years. And when it's yours, I'll have to settle money to bring you another £500 per annum, and that will mean that much off my income, and we'll not be able to live in France, and I and Papa will be driven home to your seaside shack and ask for shelter, and your beastly tart wife will be like Goneril and Regan merged, and bang the flimsy door in our noses, and we'll get a sheer hulk on Pagham or Bosom Marsh, as Peggotty did before us, and Papa will make love to the paid help, and I will be the real Mrs. Gummidge. So I said to Mr. Hart, I never wanted to see his features again, and I left, buttoning my bodice and buckling on my belt, and took myself to Mr. Mock the chiropodist, who whittled my gnarled feet into pink feathers and restored equilibrium without chasing melancholia. Nancy Mitford is in residence, calm and cool and elegant. Melanie the cow's a skeleton, the pigs far from thrifty, Colorado beetle everywhere. Jean the butler out of hand, Jacques the valet covered with blind boils and incapable of work. Mireille the cook is crossish, Maria the maid grovelling and talking such nonsense about a dying duckling and about not having the right to kill it. October 1948, at Elsie Mendel's house outside Paris. Hot as July. Hostess in slim, cool, white crepe de chine, hat shady and summery, big bow gripping it on under the chin. In a chair, of course, at 94, but attributing weakness to the chilly summer. I got the writer Ludwig Bemelmans and the King of Yugoslavia. His queen, admired by many but not by me, was dressed in stuffy sage green serge. I was dressed a bit stuffy myself in a new number made of red and black tartan. Bemelmans was exceedingly amusing about the visitation of Hollywood on Rome and the Pope. The film producer, Daryl F. Zanuck, took His Holiness a newly designed, collapsible, streamlined, stay-bright-shelled, plastic, portable altar. It was much appreciated by Pius XII, who could not resist playing with it throughout the interview. He, Zanuck, or another character, when asked if he wished a medal blessed, drew from his pocket not a coin, but the script of his new film. Give it every chance, I suppose. November the 15th. Unto us a son is born. Prince Charles. I've just heard it from my friend Alvild on the buzzer. I'm sorry it's not a princess. You'll be firing your guns off in the Royal Navy, I suppose. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor lunched yesterday. He told me the oldest possible chestnut is something new, i.e., if it's a boy, they'll fire 21 guns. If it's a girl, they'll fire 10. If it's a miss, they'll fire the Duke of Edinburgh. Ha ha.
In February 1949, my mother went into hospital for some much-needed rest and for some more treatment on her leg, which was still giving her a lot of trouble. Her stay was supposed to be secret, but the press soon got wind of it and, of course, jumped to the wrong conclusions.
St. John and St. Elizabeth Hospital, February 2nd, 1949. This hospital is out of the national health racket, and Cardinal Archbishop Griffin of Westminster is upstairs. The porter showed me to my room at 7 when I arrived. It looked pretty small and gloomy and threadbare, but then I couldn't see the outlook, which next morning was revealed to me in all its splendour of wide gardens and trees pressing through large, modern-style windows, each side of an angle, and outside a spacious balcony. The walls are bare and dirty, an austere crucifix the only concession, meagreish bed, fairish linen, and sordid bed table, cupboard with no hanger, well-placed light, hot and cold. I'll be all right. I told you, or I didn't, that the Evening Standard was on the warpath. We'd scotched them with a lie, I thought, but 3 days later they had two paragraphs in the Londoner's diary. I nearly had a stroke. Lady Diana resting. My whereabouts. Sir Alfred tells me she's only resting. The price of the room. She visited a plastic surgeon before going in. She wears dark spectacles and her face is swathed in light bandages. Then my age, 56, which I resent, stupidly, and a bit about my rheumatic legs, altogether too horrible and malicious. No one knew but Papa, who is no blabber. It must have come from the hospital itself, and we suspect the mother of a girl appendix opposite. She's a Mrs. McCorkerdale, and I knew her 25-odd years ago and never could like her. The nurses knew she saw me going to the diathermy department and recognised me. My spectacles are put on to hide some acid I was given to put on my cyst that drags the lower lid down. It's done no good, and chiefly so that people like her should not recognise me, and also out of a kind of vanity that forces me to hide myself when all the aides are not there, even from the nuns and maids. Can that be her? "That funny old thing," my inner ear hears them saying. "The bandages is my poor little bald-pate nightcap, which I forget arrests attention." Well, the poor nuns were dreadfully upset and felt the leak reflected on the hospital. I was for ringing up the editor and insisting on a formal denial of the report. There was no one in the office till next morning, by which time my poor pillow had counselled me to do nothing. Don't suppose it's libelous to be said to have had a facelift. I wish I'd had one. Besides, it was only an inference. If I'd got them to promise to put in any kind of retraction, which I couldn't have, they would have twisted it into another poisoned arrow, for their orders from their chief is never to spare me or Papa. What earthly interest is it for them to know where I am, or to spend days snooping for so dull a piece? Why, 3/4 of the readers no longer know who Lady Diana is. The result of it all is that the telephone never stops ringing, and it takes up my nerves and the nuns' time. Huge floral tributes arrive, which I send straight to the chapel or wards. It's a lesson never to do things in secret. February 1949. I have been invited to join a party going to Morocco. My inner eyes see this Atlas expedition as mules and cedars and long treks. The pack mules, a desperately long day of sweat and loss of direction, and suddenly when thoughts of death by exhaustion and exposure weighed on one, the silhouette of a high kasbah, trumpets signalling arrival of strangers, slaves, torches, and all the splendour and beauty of barbaric luxury within, baths of rose water, gazelles, and fountains in my bedroom. Instead, it will be American limousines whizzing one up canted roads to the doors of an Edwardian stone house from which blares a radio, a blaze of light from the ceilings, and all the discomforts of a second-class hotel. There's the rub. But I'd better go. Marrakesh, March the 3rd. The great thing is not so much new blood for refreshment, but being new blood to others. I keep the table in roars. I'm considered the wittiest, funniest, most original angel that ever visited this dull earth. It's put the morale up splendidly, though it does no good to the knee. I'm a bit behind on my day book, so let me tell you briefly that we got off at midday on a certain Monday, that we were hours at the two frontiers of Spanish Morocco, that we ate ham in fresh breads and Rumpelmeyer cakes while the fools filled forms, that we drove through the clear, radiant air, through fields of wild blue iris, past camels and poor donkeys, and that we came to Fez at about sunset, or 6:30. They made rooms somehow. The men slept together. We walked in the souks. The goods have sadly degenerated, even since 1944, when we were last here. When I think of the cheap fascinations of the 30s, the shoes and jalabas and silks and leathers and dyes and corals, now it's really the refuse of European village shops. Not a yard of real silk anywhere. It's a national unknown. Too sad. Spices they can't change, and flowers and fruit. There are still the artisans, too, hammering copper and planing sandalwood. The beggars and the filthy water seller with a bell and tepid water in a bloody goatskin. But there's no temptation to buy. Next morning we did some mosquing and souking and left at noon for the south by a mountain road. Lovely it was, and not frightening, but slow enough to give us lunch at 4:30. What a strange place it was. No town, no clients, delicious food eaten on a stoop in the sun, washed down with good red wine. We sang straight through lunch when one of our party remembered that he'd a friend called Dampierre, a resident colonel en poste nearby. So he was telephoned to, and off we rollicked to Kasbah Tala, where the little outpost was preparing for a bal musette. He's got a splendid little bar, mobile, I think, like an illuminated miniature Alhambra. There were nuts and chips and kickshaws and little glutinous squares of hashish, to sex you up a bit. Dinner very good, followed by diversions. 8 fattish, pretty ugly women jiggled around with brass cymbals on their fingers, then a chorus of boys jiggling too. The dance and the jiggle and the tune have not been changed for centuries and were never inspiring. But I liked it all right, as you can well believe.
It's here to stay.
Darling Monster was read by Patricia Hodge with John Julius Norwich. It was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 20th of December. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800. Atlantic low moving rapidly northeast, expected 450 miles southwest of Iceland, 955 by 1800 Friday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours: Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Southwesterly backing southerly later, 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later. Squally showers, rain later, good becoming moderate or poor later. Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames. West or southwest, 6 to gale 8, decreasing 4 or 5 for a time. Squally showers at first, rain later,